chemistry. And May is a brilliant logician or something like that, but maybe meant to say something else. What happened from that, for the next 6 months, he made my life miserable. I submitted my thesis. It was 10 pages. I had proven that you could do what nobody else had ever believed. I mean, I don't think you would demand that of one of your PhD students. The theory, I said to Zoe Harris, if my algorithm doesn't work, I'll do a different topic. Okay. So it was an algorithm that would prove that you could use a computer to convert a chemical name into a molecular formula. Nobody had realized that you could compute them. Everyone had always drawn a structural diagram first and then computed the molecular formula from that. That's why it took CA so goddamn long to do everything they did, you know. So I proved it. I wrote the thesis up. As a matter of fact, unbeknownst to them, a couple months later, I even submitted a preliminary communication to Nature, which was published. Mechanical translation of chemical nomenclature. It was just a very short item. Okay. And I wasn't even sure whether he was, if he found out about it, that he would have used it as prior publication and prevented me from getting my doctorate. So, anyhow, Hish said, oh, this will never do. You cannot have a 10-page dissertation. I then proceeded to write a 100-page supplement, which turned out to be a transformational analysis of Geneva nomenclature. Okay? You know, I reprinted it, and it's included in my essay, so if you really want to see it, it's all there. What happened was, I came in with this thing, he didn't understand what it was. He would look at it, and he would make some changes in it. Now, in those days, before there were word processors, before they were known to the university, Xeroxes, I would take all his little crappy little changes, this manuscript, go back to my office. I had two secretaries working with me. I had the Xerox machine. He couldn't believe it. I would be back the next day with a completely retyped manuscript. I was using what they call flex writers in those days. Okay, and I had the whole thing on tape. And finally, it got to be absurd, and I said, Henry, I don't know the first name or not. This is ridiculous. I said, you aren't going to make a decision. And he admitted to me that Harris had left him holding the bag, and nobody was going to make a decision about sending him my recommendation to graduate. I got on a telephone. And I called Zoe Harris in Rome. And I don't know if it was true or not, but I assumed that he was there with some lady. And I don't know his personal life all that well, but I said to him, Zoe, I said, you either put a cable in the works tonight, informing them to give me my PhD, or I'm going to come over there in Rome and I'm going to drag you out of bed myself. And I told him about the bargain we had made. It's really screwed me over. There was a cable came 2 days later, and Hönigswald called me over and said, you're going to get your PhD in Rome. So that's how I got my PhD in 1961. They were going to push me another year.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was what I was doing in addition to all the other.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, the thinking was all part of my work. It was a problem for me. Well, don't know if that was another diversion for me, but...
Before we move on, I noticed that you filed for a patent in 1958 on a copying and reproducing device, and you got a couple of patents on that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's called The Copywriter. There's an article I published in Current Contents about it. Is it a filing in 58 or was it issued in 58?
Well, it was a filing in 58 and then issued in 62.
There were subsequent several patents issued, and most all those are obsolete now. 62 would be obsolete, 79. And you can go out and buy some versions of a copywriter now, you know. There are such things as... And in fact, I was just reading about one that apparently is an OCR version. And there are some other, maybe some applications pending which we could file on if we choose to, but I decided to give up on that. Well, I had believed from the earliest times that what we needed was what Werner Clapp called a scholar's camera. The problem with copying machines is that you have to take the document to the machine. My idea was to bring the machine to the document. And I wanted, and the reason I had, the way I got this idea originally was, this is how I met Jack Rabinow, who is America's probably the most prolific inventor. I don't know if he'll ever come into your orbit, but he sure should. He's a fantastic guy. Well, he's an engineer. I had, because I had wide-ranging interests in information techniques, in New York, during my days at Columbia, I had been involved in a committee of call for sensory devices and aids to the blind, which the Veterans Administration had. And a fellow by the name of Eugene Murphy was the head of that department in New York. He was a marvelous man, an invalid, and I used to go down to these meetings, and they had a contract with RCA. RCA had developed a device which was a reading aid for the blind, and what you did was you scanned a text. And as you scanned the text, this thing would generate an oscillating signal, and it generated like a bird call. Okay? And believe it or not, you could literally learn those signals and translate them into the letters of the alphabet. And some of the blind people that were tested actually could learn to read that way, but it never would work because blind people are extremely sensitive to the idea of losing their hearing. And it does some, you know, constantly listening to those bird calls, they begin to lose a little bit of their high frequency sounds, and so they had to abandon that. But in that device, I saw the opportunity to have a copying machine. Instead of producing a sound, I said, let's take that signal and translate it into a copy. And I literally produced models. I even went down to the VA, and he would let me work there, where we put Teledelto's paper into the circuit. Eventually, I even got a grant for, I think, $5,000 from the Council of Library Resources. Werner Clapp wanted a thing. And the long and short of this whole thing is that the idea was just too far ahead of the technology. If you want, I could find somewhere in my closet, I've got the original models there in that article that I published in Current Contents. And I visualized, you know, the note-taking. It still is not exactly that way. The one that you can, the Japanese thing that you can buy now, it's very cumbersome, and it doesn't quite work the way it should. Eventually it'll solve the problems, but it does make copies. And there's another version now that gives you typewriter type of output, meaning the platen, and then, but there is one that you can scan this way, and they use it, the Japanese use it to copy you know, if you have to copy all those kanji characters, that could save a lot of time. So that's how I got into that. And I originally had visualized we could copy structural diagrams with it. You see, that was another motivation. And we still copy diagrams a lot here, but by camera.
Did you try to, aside from these...
Well, we formed a company. It's called... So we still have the corporation, Selective Information Devices. But what I failed to do there was to turn it over to... I tried at various stages to do this. To get a separate company formed, to get a business manager, and to get venture capital for it. That's what it needs. And I just... I guess I was never really good enough manager to realize that I had to get people like that to run a thing like that. I couldn't just do it part-time. You know, it just was just another diversion, which I should have turned over to somebody else. Well, maybe they were lucky because it took the technology just wasn't there for 20 years. Now you've got all these semiconductors and what have you that make it feasible.
How much of your own time and energy has gone into the sales side of the organization?
A lot. I always think that I have been a consummate salesman. I was always very eager to talk to people about our products and pursued leads. I was a super salesman. That was something that I didn't leave entirely. I still don't. I mean, I still have the temptation to get on the phone and tell somebody about what we got. And I've always wanted to engage in constant dialogue with the customers. And I seem to be able to, in talking to them, even help them figure out what they wanted. And then if there were enough of them said they wanted it, give it to them. Like I did with the drug companies, you know, this thing. You know, get 12 of them together and, you know, look, you can't all have it your way. You got to compromise and we'll give you a product that all of you can use. It's a shared concept. Everybody wants personalized software, but they can't afford it. So, that's what it's all about. I mean, I got tired of doing the same thing over and over again for the same people. Why not give this product that everybody can use? Well, you still see problems with that today. Everybody, we have custom contents, you know, that's how we got the ASCA SD. We had the first commercial SDI service, still going. It's a vastly underutilized service. Maybe it'll come to its heyday someday, so I don't know. In a sense, it already has with the online networks, because in reverse, you get SDI, but on the online. I had librarians who couldn't recognize that I had been giving them that service 20 years ago, and I said, oh, we do it online now. They spend a lot more for it online than they do with our service, but that's another thing you find, that the cheapest price is not always the best. You can't deliver the best service. I think that's one of the things that was wrong with that. We shouldn't have made it so cheap. We should have made it better, made it easier in other ways, even included documents. But that's
in the early 60s, you got current contents, you got Index Chemicus, and you've got the Genetic Citation Index turning into the Science Citation Index.
Yeah.
As you look over the 25 years approximately from there till now, what are the peaks that stand out? Developing and diversifying.
Well, you got to realize that you may not look at it as a different product, but the decision to publish accumulations is a major risk decision. But it's turned out to be the most important financial decision we ever made. That carried over not only with accumulations that we have done.
More libraries like them?
No, it just means that additional revenue that we could get, and it improves the utility of it, makes it less cumbersome to use. And then we also went back and did this 1955 to 64. We went back and did back years. I mean, that was unheard of. I'm very proud of that. I mean, it'll be a major tool, I think, for the historian of science. And now we're almost finished with 45 to 54. Who would have thought that anybody would pay $25,000 for that set of books? That's what it had to be, and I knew that it had to be. I mean, I could have taken a bath for it, but somehow, you know, instinctively, I just thought, oh, 25 was about it. And there's only going to be a couple hundred libraries that will ever buy it anyhow. That's what it takes. Same thing with the new. So hopefully all those libraries will continue to go with the thing till we go back to the, to 1900 if we can. And every time you do it, you realize there are projects that people find great use for it. Once it's out, then historians will see and others will see utility for it. I mean, even to this day, we still like to answer the question, who was citing Avery McLeod and McCarthy in those intervening years? Well, I got some preliminary data for people before this index was out, but now we'll have answers to things like that. Amazing how many things that are still important today are traceable to that period, post-war years. Well, by the same token, well, how many were pre-war? Yeah. It goes on and on. Never stops.
So you get right the way back to the Royal Society Catalogue of Scientific Literature.
Yeah, I mean, really, when you, every once in a while you see, my God, somebody thought about that in 1870. I mean, I wonder what was going on in those few years. I mean, when you think the way I do in citation terms, you've got to have that index for every year where there's a possible citation. The trouble is that I think that as you get back to the 1900s, the citation practices really got sloppy, so you've got to do real textual analysis. And the journals didn't have the formalized citations, so you got to do what we do now with social science stuff. And there's, you know, we haven't gone back to the early period yet for the social science. We've got 66 onward. We're producing 56 to 66 now. And the arts and humanities, I don't know when we'll ever go back and do that. Because they're the place where you really could use it if they can least afford it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're lucky if we get them to buy it now, currently.
Well, one day that might be something NEH one day might.
We sure have a facility for doing it in Ireland now.
Yeah.
And I hope that we can, if we cost it out, figure out that it would be something that a typical customer could afford. I don't know. It's a very labor-intensive work.
Yeah. I should think NEH might really be interested in that from in due course when the science...
If somebody like you suggested it, maybe. If I, you see, I've always had that conflict of interest. When I go to these foundations, I have to interpret what I want as being, you know, self-interest, and in a certain sense it is. And, I mean, if somebody else may be able to come up with a deal, I would gladly do those back things for them at a cost plus, you know, I mean, I wouldn't just to get it done, but...
I think when the science one is further along, it'd be appropriate to say, since we need it more...
How further along, I don't know. But, well, I think the compact disc will change things a lot, because there'll be a lot of pressure on us to put that on a compact disc. I mean, I think you could put that whole darn thing on two discs, right? And that makes it so much more accessible to so many more people. And I think the individual professor in the humanities could conceivably have the Arts and Humanities right at his own desk. I mean, that's the way you should have it. No, it's like having the OED. These tools should be the scholar's tools, and that was my ultimate hope.
What's changed about your own work as ISI has grown?
Well, I used to be far more heavily involved in day-to-day work, day-to-day things than I am now. Over the years, I have let my interest in writing take over a lot of my time, although I developed a particular editorial team and style that makes it, you know, fairly efficient. Trained a lot of good writers have left me. Similar thing with the newspaper, but I feel far more removed from things than I used to. You just can't. Recently had a very sad experience with bringing in a chief operating officer who just did not understand the business and had some other problems. And so that would have, if it had worked out right, would have given me more time to devote to R&D and editorial. That's basically where I'm interested, new product development. There's so many things that could be done with this database that just haven't been done. So that doesn't mean that they would be profitable, but useful. And a lot of people who are willing to pay for it on a cost basis can get a lot of interesting stuff out of it as well. But I think it's a tragedy that, you know, I did the study of the 1,000 most cited authors. I did that as an editorial project. It cost us unbelievable amount. We spent over $100,000 to do that article, that series. I can't get a grant to do these things easily. There's the data, and I would gladly do that study. I've been waiting 3 years to do just a follow-up of the 400 new names. I've got the names, but I just can't afford the cost of untangling all the, you know, because I don't want to do wrong data. Now, untangling the homographs is the big problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought of setting up some kind of a non-profit foundation that might do that. But again, that takes time too,
mm-hmm.
and energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you got to be able to hire somebody to do that, right? Apply for the grants, which is something we should have paid more attention to. But we've had ups and downs. I guess I've had a lot of people come and go here who are not necessarily as loyal to ISI as I might have expected, and maybe I was unreasonably expecting them to stick with it, but, you know, a lot of other people are using our data for all kinds of purposes. If we can, I'd like to see this International Science Indicators project get off the ground, but it's just taking a long time to.
Let me take you over to the scientist for a minute or two, because like so many other things you've done, the germ of it goes way back.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, will you be in Worcester, Mass?
I'm hoping to make an appearance, yeah.
On Thursday, is it?
It's Thursday,
yeah,
Friday.
Thursday
Saturday.
Evening. I will be reading from letters by Derek Price.
In that
session.
Okay.
And I've got one of the letters right here that I'm going to be reading about. The fact is that the newspaper idea is goes back so far that it includes a proposal that I made to the National Science Foundation, which I actually forgot about, a formal proposal to publish a citation index in a newspaper format. And Derek refers to that in one of his letters. In his letter of March 8, 1963, he says, Dear Gene, as regards the Science newspaper, I see we have rather different ideas. My own notion is for something that looks very much like the Wall Street Journal, but substituting bibliographic indexes for the stock market prices, and having a page for each of the chief sciences written in the style of fairly meaty reviews, with the addition of a more newsy column for the experts in other fields, and of course with the front page of the Daily devoted to the main social and political news and gory details of all the breakthroughs. If you have not done so, would you send a copy of your proposal to Anthony Michaelis? So it's, it goes back quite a ways. And, what's missing here is a copy of my proposal. I thought I asked for a copy of that. That's not here. I'll have to get it out. But what else can I tell you about the newspaper editorial? The story about it is told in a condensed form in the last year, that article I did in the current contents. But,
I think we really want to conclude this interview, this history, not by concluding, because the history is only in the middle, but by, in a way, probably asking you to take a little bit of a look forward. What do you think your own preoccupations are going to be in the next several years? Is it?
Well, you may have heard from other people, when an organization gets apparently beyond the magic number of about 400 or 500 people, it takes on a different kind of life. It takes a different kind of management to run it. And I think that one way or another, ISI will have to get linked in with probably more capital, more technology, people with vast resources, like, you know, we're dealing with satellite communications, all sorts of things, and I think that unless we're extremely lucky, it'll be difficult to finance all of these new technological developments. I mean, it's cost us a great deal to do the CD-ROM. Either we'd have to go back and become a small company, so to speak, that stagnates or hangs on for the rest of my life, or it becomes really significantly big. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if, by one series of transformations or another, this went from a $40 million to a $100 million company in 5 years or something like that. Where that leaves me, it's not clear, but one way or the other, I'm sure I'll have a role in it, but and I hope it'll, you know, I'll be still involved in the idea stage of the editorial. I don't want to be, I mean, the newspaper has to have a kind of integrity that I want on it, and if it changes, it has to change. If that become like a yellow dog kind of a thing, I just soon get rid of it. It's not easy to, I never thought it would be so difficult to work with people in getting an editorial product that does satisfy your desires without your having to sit and manage it every minute. So, as a publisher, it's a different kind of role for me, and it's something I have to decide how much time I'm going to give to that, and I have to sacrifice other things to do it. You know, some people would know, I could just spend all my time devoted to current contents, and it would be by its own universe, and it would improve in many ways that I haven't had time to spend on it. Monies that we spent on other things could have gone into making it much better. But then I had the fun of doing the other things. SCI has got all kinds of dimensions to it that need to be expanded. I hope that Chemical Abstracts and the others will, you know, it ought to be up on their network. I want to do the chemistry citation index. I mean, the whole thing ought not to be separated. How you get all these organizations together is hard, but eventually it has to happen. But even the index chemicals, I don't know. As they get better, does it become redundant? It's funny that drug companies still think it's necessary, but in a certain sense, conceptually, it's odd that CA still hasn't been able to do what is necessary. Maybe we could just join it together. I don't know. So I think I don't really want to spend the rest of my time doing things that are not really necessary that other people can do just as well. The Atlas of Science is, of course, the next big project that I think, as a matter of fact, when they started it, it's the harbinger of things to come. It has almost infinite possibilities. I mean, we're only planning 12 sections right now, but I mean, it could easily be 100.
Is it still going?